Public Radio International. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. In the years between 1650 and 1835, European scholars conducted an intense and complex debate about the skin color of Africans. They were seeking a basis for establishing European and non-European physical identities. The way they conducted that debate and what they took under consideration influence Western thinking about racial matters to this day. In large measure, their efforts and their motivations moved our historic view from one focused on nations to one set upon races. My guest is Renato Mazzolini, professor of the history of science at the University of Trent in Italy. Renato, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much, George.
As I've just said, Renato, during the 17th and 18th centuries, I've learned that there was an intense debate over the skin color of Africans among scientific circles in Europe. Now, I would just guess, as a layperson, it's probably very significant that this took place during one of the high points of the slave trade. But I'd love for you to tell us, in more explicit form, exactly why did this begin? Why was this debate undertaken?
The why, of course, is difficult. As you pointed out, it took place in the high points of the slave trade. And I think that one of the reasons was that when Europeans used Africans as slaves in older colonies, and as Europeans, I mean, not only the English and the French and the Spaniards and the Portuguese, but also, of course, the Dutch, the Swedes and the Danes, who also had plantations in the Caribbean. Well, they were, as you mentioned at the beginning, they were seeking a physical identity, and they saw themselves as whites. Now, this seeing themselves as whites is something really new. You don't find an expression whites, either during the Middle Ages or in ancient times. So formulas that we still use today as color, the blacks, whites, have an origin during the 17th century and the 18th century. And it is, of course, striking, it was striking for me to notice how much this problem was discussed.
This is fascinating to me, Renato. Tell us a bit about how much it was discussed and who was discussing it as well.
Yes, let me say, for instance, the first person who speaks about the problem in three chapters of a book devoted to vulgar errors is a man, an Englishman named Thomas Brown, and he was a physician. And he, as I said, devotes three chapters to the problem. And he asks, why are Africans black? And he analyzes two different theories present in his day. One was what is named the climatic theory. They are black because they live near the tropics. The tropics is nearer to the sun, and therefore they're face is scorched. This was the ancient theory. And another theory he discusses is that according to which the blacks are black because Noah's condemned one of his sons, but actually one of his nephews. And according to a very strange tradition, the origin of which is not up to now clear, not all, because of this condemnation, they became darker.
This is interesting to me, Renato, very interesting. Let me ask you a number of things about it right away. Mm-hmm. First of all, were other non-European groups studied in this way by Europeans at that time?
No, absolutely no. And one of the astonishing things of my research is the following, that physicians and especially anatomists, they carried out a great number of dissections in the second half of the 17th and during the 18th and early 19th century of Africans with the purpose of studying the seat of what we would call, say today, pigmentation, and also the causes of this pigmentation. Now, I have counted many of these dissections. You know, there are at least 38 which we can certainly establish and say, yes, these have been actually carried out. What is astonishing is the fact that no dissection of, for instance, Red Indians have been carried out in that period, or of Chinese or Japanese.
Interesting.
And this is, I think, a rather impressive element, especially if you think that a classification then of mankind was carried out on the basis also of this dissection.
As I say, Renato, this is absolutely fascinating to me. Contrast for us this state of affairs with, in a general sense at least, what in the classical period European views toward Africans and racial matters might have been.
In classical antiquity, as has been shown by a number of scholars, there was not a color prejudice. And we must always think that the Mediterranean society, first of all, the Egyptian society, was a mixed society. And the same applies, of course, to the Roman Empire. Generally speaking, real empires are always, we would call them today, interracial. More races participate to the empire. This, at least for the ancient world. And for this reason, I think that, and Africans, also during the Middle Ages, were seen positively for a number of reasons. First of all, we have to remember that before the discoveries of the Americas, gold came from sub-Saharan regions as Nigeria. And then, of course, there is the story of the Three Kings.
Yes.
And the Ethiopian, and of course Ethiopia has a very important role also within the Christian world. So Africans were seen generally favorably, also during the Middle Ages. And this is why I say that things really change with the slave trade.
This is,
and I mean, this is my impression. The image of the African changes.
To what extent, and if to any significant extent, how did this filter down into popular attitudes? We're talking now about a very erudite sector of the population, but did this scientific research get reflected in popular literature and popular attitudes, that kind of thing?
Yes, I think it did. We can see this through a number of sources, mainly encyclopedias and dictionaries of the 18th and early 19th century. But I think the way in which it mainly struck the popular vision is when physical anthropology itself grew as a discipline, that is to say at the end of the 18th century, and when one term that up to that time had not been very popular, the term of race, was used more and more. Now, this is a very ambiguous term, and it was used by scientists as a mean of classification, and it was, of course, used then also by philologists, linguists, and by historians. And then it became of great popular use.
And lasting.
Yeah,
popular
and
use,
lasting popular use. So my opinion is that scientists first were concerned with color, and then later they were concerned with other physical characteristics.
Yes.
Color was less important, but it was color that enabled them to make a first classification,
and
distinctions.
Let me add something right now, just from having heard you and having read some of your writing on this. You make an excellent point that after color, they went into other areas. Mm-hmm. One that fascinated me, and I'd love to get your views on this, was what they called sensibility or sensitivity as a quality.
Yeah.
Now, let me risk a judgment or an opinion, which is wrongheaded, you correct me, but it seemed to me that that was or could have been a way of trying to rationalize treatment of a people. You know,
with no doubt.
Yes, by saying they have a different kind of sensitivity than we have. Yeah. Is this right? Yeah.
Yes, I think it is, because technically speaking, we have to think, of course, that the knowledge of the skin structures in the 17th and 18th century was quite different from the one we have today. But however, there were some anatomists and physiologists who thought that this pigmentation somehow made Africans less sensitive, which meant really that if they were badly treated physically, whipped, they would feel less, simply because they had another covering, another layer somehow. And it is nice to follow up to these details, sometimes the nonsense that was expressed in that in those years. Because one really has the impression here that the scientists were really trying to provide arguments in favor of slavery. Mm. How diffused were these arguments, I cannot know. Yeah. I mean, it's very hard to establish. But however, the fact that there are quite a number in the specific literature suggests that they might have been of a more popular knowledge.
This is an excellent excellent point, Renato. You are really helping me and I think everyone understand how this wittingly or unwittingly began to play into and justify a certain system. And it also, I think you also help us understand as an historian that science is never conducted in a vacuum.
No, absolutely not.
It's in a context. And could you tell us a bit about that? I mean, what kind of a period
one
are we dealing
of, you
with?
Know, one of the very striking things is I always, one of the reasons also why I carried out this sort of research is that Galileo used to consider secondary qualities such as color as an area of which science should not be based upon. It should not be based upon colors or taste and things of this kind. Now, it is striking to see that something so important as the study of human diversity is then based really on color. This is the first thing. The second is, of course, as you said, it's not carried out in a vacuum. With no doubt, European scientists were aware of the slave trade. And as I said before, some could be in favor, and some, and I'm happy to say the greatest anthropologists of the end of the 18th century as Buffon, Blumenbach, and Camper were very much against the slave trade. And they spoke of the Africans as their Ethiopian brother. This repeatedly. And I think in the case of those three anthropologists, their sense of responsibility was quite high. You see, today our sensibility on these problems is much higher than it was then. And therefore, of course, you can take some of their passages and, say, they were a racist. They were racist. But as a matter of fact, if you look at the complex, the totality of their work, then you see that they had a completely a non-hierarchical vision of humanity, some of them.
So the entire record must be read and
I
touched.
Think, yes, yeah. in a bit different way.
You know, Renato, we have placed, thanks to your scholarship, the origins of this in about the year 1650.
Mm-hmm.
And also, from your research, we're placing the end point at roughly 1835. So I guess a logical question is why? What happens in 1835?
Yeah, yes, I would say really 1835 up to end of the 1848 also. Well, first of all, it has to do with the abolition of the slave trade, with the fact that slavery is eliminated in the English colonies, and then in 48 also in the French colonies. But the abolition, of course, of the slave trade and of slavery on the part of the more powerful European nations does not mean an end of my problem, of the problem of pigmentation on the one hand, and of the question, why are Africans black? As a matter of fact, the racial and racist interpretation, or scientific racism, really develops exactly when there is the abolition of the slave trade.
This is interesting. And
this is one of the most strange things. It seems as if somehow, in the moment in which Europeans abolish slavery, they have to introduce scientific racism. And the texts of this middle of the 19th century and of the second part of the 19th century are incomparably more racist than those of the 18th or of the 17th century. And probably are also so hard that it is for me one of the reasons why I stopped is also a psychological one. It's some things are so horrid to read that probably one needs a thicker skin
sensibility,
to read them. Less sensibility probably.
Renato, that is, quite frankly, that's a stunning point. I'm glad you made it, because I don't think there are very many people who know that.
Yes, so I it is rather impressive, the fact that as I said, racial scientific racism is somehow a reaction to the abolition of the slave trade. This is one of my impressions. I might be wrong, of course, but there are many elements that hint at this.
Yeah, there's so much to talk to you about. Let me just take a moment to say that this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest today is Renato Marzolini, professor of the History of Science at the University of Trent in Italy. Currently a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center, Renato Marzolini was educated at universities in Italy and Switzerland. You know, Renato, one of the impressions that I had previously, and it's been confirmed in our conversation, is this one. Quite simply and directly, the fact that European scientists in a given period spent so much time and so much resource devoted to this particular issue strikes me as in and of itself of tremendous historical importance.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, quite frankly, with the exception of the work you're doing, I don't know of anyone else, and maybe there are some others, but certainly not very many. So the question is this: has this been given the kind of historical attention it deserves?
You see, people have generally been concentrated on the question of race, and race is a concept. I much prefer something which is not a concept, as color, where, of course, there are differences, and these exist, but the question is, how do you interpret them? What is the meaning? And you see, many authors nowadays believe that race is only a social construction as a concept. And there is much to be said in favor of this thesis. But then there are also some elements, of differences within human groups. And this is a lot of serious research has been done on these differences. And it doesn't mean that if you are studying these differences, you are doing something racist. They are, fortunately, we are all different. Also within a group, a nation, or anything, we are all individually different. And the question of human diversity is of enormous significance. It becomes tragic when completely biological element is related to mental abilities, as has been done a lot in the 19th century, and also, I'm afraid to say, in this century.
Yeah, and when that happens, does it not, I won't go so far as to say discredit the field, but it certainly makes it much more difficult for...
I think it also discredits the field.
Yeah. Here are some psychological reactions I personally had as I was thinking about your topic and research. And again, Renato, you know, tell me if I'm right or wrong about them and give me your views. First of all, I was struck by this. It seemed to be, and I accept your distinction, that some scientists in that period were certainly not concerned with trying to prove a quote, racial point. Mm-hmm. Others might have been. But that to one degree or another, there seemed to be a need to promote or advance or declare the superiority of European culture.
With no doubt. Uh-huh. With no doubt. But this, you see, is a parallel development. If you look at Europe in the 17th century and you compare the Europeans or the European nations of the, let us say, 16th century, to make it, to the Ottoman Empire, you see there are no great differences. Really, Europe builds up its strength during the 16th, 17th, and 18th century in navigation and in the sciences, and of course military power. And with it came a sense of great superiority. It's incredible that they should try to ground, at the end of the 18th and in the early 19th century, this superiority in certain fields, which undoubtedly they had, on biological characteristics. This is, I think, irrational. But of course, we are seeing at this with another sensibility, that of our time, which shows that actually things change, fortunately. But if we look back at that period, it still remains a problem why they should link a superiority that was attained in certain areas, as the sciences, for instance, with a biological characteristic. Therefore, if you said in the early 19th century, white, you meant civilized, and colored, you meant non-civilized.
Yeah, that was
just think that, for instance, only the term civilization is a term of the late 17th century. They didn't have it before. And one of also of the interesting facts is this, that while, for instance, European scholars of the 17th and early 18th century still looked at Africa as a series of kingdoms, nations. In the 19th century, they just look at them as races. And then they will add races with no history.
Exactly.
And this is, you know, whereas, strangely, during the Renaissance, there was a knowledge of the history, of the various histories of Africa, mainly Northern Africa, of course, down to Ethiopia. But also some quite a lot about the present-day Nigeria. In the 19th century, all of this seems to fade away, and there is, of course, this is also explainable with the colonialism of the 19th century, when both the French and the English start to penetrate into Africa.
But you know, the striking thing about that point, Renato, is that it's... we tend to forget how often we humans regress in our knowledge,
of course,
as well as advance. Tell me this as an historian of the field. Is this period that you're studying the first or the major period when, to use my phrase, science becomes used to validate social attitudes by many? Is this a new thing in itself, the use of science to justify
this,
things?
This I would have to think about. Probably there have been other instances, but within, of course, the social realm, I would say that it is mainly end of the 18th and early 19th century that this happens, and that a very strong alliance takes place between historiography and physical anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
And this alliance has been, now we can say, lethal to much of European thinking.
Precisely the point I wanted you to bring us to, and I wanted to ask you the question about the effect of all of this that we've discussed on the discipline of physical anthropology.
The effect is, of course, that nowadays some themes that are, I think, of great relevance, one is at times have become somehow taboo. One is at times afraid to investigate some areas because one might fear there are social implications. And this is, of course, also a negative aspect. And I think that some themes should be investigated anew.
But they've been inhibited.
They have been partly inhibited.
Renato, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I always like to conclude a conversation, particularly one this rich, by asking my guest a very speculative kind of crystal ball question. And this occurred to me, and you react to it, that since the period that you are studying, if anything, our reliance on science has grown enormously. I think that's beyond dispute, and it's certainly also true that's going to continue. The importance of science to the way life is conducted is just overwhelmingly important. I tried to think of an area of scientific inquiry today that may be posing not the same questions, but questions of equal philosophical and ethical importance, questions of as deep a moral dimension as is the issue we have been discussing today. And this struck me, Renato, that perhaps it's biotechnology, as it's developing now, that's becoming the kind of crux of all these interests in the world of science. If that's true, do you, as an historian of science, feel confident that the debate is better conducted today? And what are the lessons from the period that you've studied that might help us conduct it better?
Well, I probably I am not in the state of answering this question, because, strangely enough, I although I do follow things of contemporary history of my own day, only to a point. One thing I believe, however, significant is that scientists should have in their training also a training in history, general history, simply because it's general history that makes them aware of the traps of their own field. And it is only by seeing themselves immersed in globality that probably they might be able to see the consequences, unexpected consequences of some of their activities, scientific activities.
I think that's an excellent answer, because you remind us all that science is a part of society. And as in any field of such importance, knowing the history of your society is tremendously important to what you seek to do. I think that's very wise, Renato.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Renato Mazzolini, professor of the history of science at the University of Trent in Italy. I am George Listencié, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
PRI. Public Radio International.